All right, here we go. Time now for the reading of today's Wall Street Journal here on the Talking Information Center. It is Thursday. It is the 4th of December, 2025, and that means we say hello with the Wall Street Journal to Ken.
Hello and welcome. In Wednesday's markets, small stocks rally on rate hopes. The prospect of lower interest rates lifted shares of smaller companies on Wednesday. The Russell 2000 index of small-cap companies rose 1.9%, leading gains among major U.S. stock benchmarks. Investors expect lower rates will decrease borrowing costs and boost economic growth, lifting profits at small companies. Just a few weeks ago, traders put the odds of an interest rate cut at the Federal Reserve's December 10th meeting at less than 50%. Since then, the chances have surged to nearly 90%, according to interstate futures tracked by CME FedWatch. Further signs of a weakening job market juiced investors' rate cut optimism on Wednesday. A report from payroll processor ADP showed that private hiring sank in November, with the sector shedding some 32,000 jobs. That helped boost other indexes as well. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 0.9%, or around 408 points. The S&P 500 rose 0.3% and is just 0.6% off the all-time highs it notched in October. United Health Group added 4.7% to lead the Dow Industrials. Goldman Sachs gained 2.6%. But rising hopes for falling rates are hurting the dollar. The Wall Street Journal dollar index has fallen for 7 consecutive trading days, on course for its longest losing streak since July 2020. Lower rates generally decrease the value of a country's currency. And as U.S. investors prepare for the Fed to cut again, policymakers across the globe are taking a different path. The Bank of Japan governor signaled earlier this week that the country's central bank might raise rates later this month. The dollar is poised to continue weakening, said Jose Torres, senior economist at Interactive Brokers. And a couple articles from the Herd on the Street page. NVIDIA's fat margins are rivals opening. The company's leading position in AI chips is secure, but its profit margins look vulnerable. The AI revolution has created a unique and high-quality problem for NVIDIA. The chip maker makes too much money. NVIDIA has fallen under scrutiny over the past month as investors have come to worry about the sustainability of blowout artificial intelligence spending. But another fear surfaced last week with reports that Google is looking to enter the AI chip market by selling the chip it designed in-house, known as a Tensor Processing Unit, or TPU, for its own computing needs. NVIDIA's stock price picked up some ground this week, but the shares are down 12% since the company peaked at a $5 trillion market cap in late October. The Nasdaq composite lost about 2% in the same time. The recent decline has made the world's most valuable company look cheap. NVIDIA's stock trades around 26 times projected earnings for the next 4 quarters, close to its lowest multiple over the past 5 years, according to FactSet data. But the ratio is based on earnings expected over the next year that could come under pressure if stronger competition forces NVIDIA to lower prices. A haircut to earnings would still leave NVIDIA more profitable than most other chip companies, but the stock wouldn't be quite the bargain it seems to be, despite the company's commanding lead in the lucrative AI chip market. How lucrative? NVIDIA generated a little over $110 billion in operating income over the past 4 quarters. That equates to about 59 cents of operating profit for every dollar of revenue, far above what any other chip company on the PHLX Semiconductor Index commanded over the same period, according to data from S&P Global Markets Intelligence. TSMC, the Taiwan manufacturing powerhouse that makes most of NVIDIA's chips, produced an operating margin of just under 50% for the same period, while the average for companies on the index is about 25%. NVIDIA's gross margins, which reflect the direct costs of producing a company's products, now stands at 70% annually. That compares with an average of about 62% for the five-year period before sales exploded in mid-2023 from AI demand. NVIDIA then credited the gross margin jump to a significant amount of software and complexity in its data center products. Fabless chip companies Qualcomm, Advanced Micro Devices, and Marvell, which also outsource their manufacturing, commanded annual gross margins in the low 50% range, according to data from S&P Global Market Intelligence. AMD's margins are particularly notable, given that the company is gearing up for a major challenge to NVIDIA's dominance in the AI computing market. The MI450 chips that the company plans to start shipping next year already landed a major customer in OpenAI, and AMD chief executive Lisa Su told analysts last month that more major customers are coming. Neither NVIDIA nor AMD has publicly disclosed prices for their AI chips, which are generally customized for each major customer, making direct comparisons difficult. But their sharply different profitability levels give AMD the advantage of being able to underprice NVIDIA and still boost its margins. The company, in fact, has publicly committed to surpassing 35% in annual pro forma operating margins over the next 3 to 5 years, compared with 22% now. AMD's pro forma margins exclude the cost of stock-based compensation and other charges. Now, competition from Google adds a new wrinkle as the search giant has a highly profitable advertising business that can support an ambitious new venture like directly entering the AI chip market. Parent Alphabet's operating cash flow of $151.4 billion over the past 4 quarters is the highest on the S&P 500. And landing a customer like Facebook parent Meta Platforms would be a big win for Google's TPU efforts. Meta is a major NVIDIA customer, but has a strong need to secure as many AI chips as it can, given Mark Zuckerberg's ambitious goal of developing superintelligence before rivals like OpenAI get there. News Corp owner of the Wall Street Journal, has a commercial agreement to supply content on Google platform. Analysts aren't panicking about NVIDIA yet. In the near term, Meta using TPUs doesn't materially affect our viewpoint on NVIDIA, despite the narrative headwind it creates, Morgan Stanley's Joe Moore wrote in a note to clients last week. Google is still a major NVIDIA customer and frequently touts its access to the company's most advanced products. Moore estimates Google spends about $20 billion a year on NVIDIA chips. But Wall Street is keenly focused on NVIDIA maintaining gross margins in the 70% range, even with sharply rising costs for key components like memory. And Google's latest chip advances, plus new offerings from AMD and Amazon.com's latest Trainium 3 chip, announced on Tuesday, show competition keeps picking up for a key market that NVIDIA has long dominated. NVIDIA's ability to maintain pricing power and its high margins will only get harder from here. Free stock trading is expensive. Hundreds of Oprah fans got a nasty surprise 20 years ago. In the most iconic moment of her talk show career, she delighted 276 audience members in 2004 with a free Pontiac G6. You get a car, you get a car, everybody gets a car. Everybody also got a tax bill of several thousand dollars the following year. There were some lightly used Pontiacs for sale and lessons learned. Wall Street has learned something about free stuff, too, and executives are still pinching themselves. About half of all new U.S. brokerage accounts between 2016 and 2021 were opened at upstart Robinhood, which built its business around having no trade commissions. When much larger competitors Schwab, TD Ameritrade, E-Trade, and Fidelity followed suit, It was a scary moment. Not everyone is going to survive this, predicted one expert cited by the Wall Street Journal in 2019. They didn't just survive, they boomed. Schwab shares are up 150%. Morgan Stanley snapped up E-Trade for a big premium, and its chief financial officer gushed about the jump in business in 2021. More clients, more engagement, more activity, more cash, he said, calling the number of trades off the charts. Brokers didn't account for the zero price effect. Introductory college economics classes teach us that lower prices spur more demand, but that goes into overdrive behaviorally when hedonic goods, things or services that are enjoyable, go from cheap to free. Judging by the surge that followed, trading stocks really must be fun. Average daily share volume on and off U.S. exchanges has nearly tripled since 2017 and is up by a lot more than that in dollar terms. The frenzy has more than made up for the loss of commissions. Brokers have other ways of being paid, such as holding your cash or, for some, payment for order flow. That means getting compensated by market makers who take a tiny cut to handle trades off of a stock exchange. All told, the profits that have flowed to brokers and market makers and the increases in their market value easily add up to $500 billion. Not too shabby after making their main service free. That doesn't even count exchange-traded fund issuers who are enjoying a golden era. And let's not get started on special purpose acquisition companies which boomed, busted, and are making a comeback. The laws of economics haven't been rewritten, though. Very active investors probably feel better off because the value of all U.S. stocks has risen so much. But proportionally, more of their wealth is being left on the table through booming share and option trading or gimmicky ETFs. Studies show there is an inverse relationship between how often someone trades and their returns. Those foregone gains go somewhere, and it isn't money heaven. Altman weighs rival to SpaceX. OpenAI CEO considers acquiring or partnering with rocket company. OpenAI chief executive Sam Altman has explored putting together funds to either acquire or partner with a rocket company, a move that would position him to compete against Elon Musk's SpaceX. Altman reached out to at least one rocket maker, Stoke Space, in the summer, and the discussions picked up in the fall, according to people familiar with the talks. Among the proposals was for OpenAI to make a series of equity investments in the company and end up with a controlling stake. Such an investment would total billions of dollars over time. The talks are no longer active, people close to OpenAI said. Altman and OpenAI are facing market headwinds after striking hundreds of billions of dollars in computing deals without publicly offering a clear picture of how the startup will pay for the build-out. OpenAI on Monday declared a code red to improve ChatGPT after it began losing market share to Google's Gemini chatbot. As a result, OpenAI is delaying the rollout of other products, including advertising, and encouraging employees to temporarily transfer teams to work on the chatbot. Altman has been interested in the possibility of building data centers in space for some time, suggesting that the insatiable demand for computing resources to power artificial intelligence systems eventually could require so much power that the environmental consequences would make space a better option. Orbital data centers would allow companies to harness the power of the sun to operate them, advocates say. Founded by former employees at Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin, Stoke is working on building a fully reusable rocket, something SpaceX is also attempting to pull off. Tech CEOs, including Bezos, Musk, and Google's Sundar Pichai, have extolled the possibility of building AI computing clusters in space. The concept is unproved, although Alphabet's Google and satellite operator Planet Labs struck a deal to send up two prototype satellites with Google AI chips on board in 2027. I do guess that a lot of the world gets covered in data centers over time, Altman recently said on a podcast with Theo Vaughn. Like, maybe we build a big Dyson sphere around the solar system and say, hey, it actually makes no sense to put these on Earth. The discussions over a potential rocket investment began taking shape when market enthusiasm for AI was at its peak. Altman announced a series of chip and data center deals in September and October with companies including Oracle, NVIDIA, Advanced Micro Devices, and others. Investors greeted those announcements warmly, with Oracle and NVIDIA shares rising rapidly in the weeks after the announcement, where Altman promised a vast build-out of computing warehouses. But the market has since soured on expansionist AI ambitions, with Oracle shares falling about 19% in the past month and NVIDIA declining some 13%. OpenAI signed up for almost $600 billion in new computing commitments in the past few months alone, raising questions about how it will pay for the developments. News Corp, owner of the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones Newswires, has a content licensing partnership with OpenAI. Amazon delivery businesses seek to unite. Amazon.com is facing a new labor challenge, this time from small business owners who run the company's package delivery network. A group calling itself DSPs, for Equitable and Fair Treatment, or DEFT, went public on Black Friday, saying its goal is to organize the company's roughly 2,400 delivery service providers to fight for better terms and reverse policies they say wipe out their profits. The founders, who have yet to reveal their identities in public, are aiming for Amazon to increase pay for package deliveries and reimbursement for van usage and loosen the criteria for bonus payouts. The group has been in the works since this summer, when delivery fleet owners started receiving surprise bills for van repairs, some surpassing $100,000. An outcry by owners on Amazon's internal forums, partly organized in encrypted Signal chats, led to Amazon reversing the fees. The victory inspired DEFT's founders to create a formal organization as a chapter of the American Association of Franchisees and Dealers. Amazon has faced attempts to organize warehouse workers and truck drivers. The company has opposed those efforts, but also raised wages for the groups. DEFT's founders are hoping to obtain similar concessions by signing up enough delivery companies to force Amazon to give them a say in new policies or reverse old ones. My hope is that DEFT will be a voice for the voiceless. DEFT is the answer to those of you who are pleading to help and feel you're screaming into the void, one of the group's founders wrote in a Signal chat with fellow owners viewed by the Wall Street Journal. The vast majority of delivery service partners in our program are running successful, profitable businesses, and claims to the contrary are factually inaccurate, an Amazon spokesperson said. Our data show DSP profitability is strong and has consistently improved year over year. The Amazon spokesperson said the company consults with a group of DSPs about policy changes. Previous attempts to unionize other areas of Amazon's business have been met with resistance, with some workers alleging they were fired in retaliation for wanting to join a union. Last December, Amazon employees at seven warehouses joined the Teamsters to go on strike, in part because the company refused to recognize the union's representation. In building DEFT's membership, the founders are taking steps to shield members' identities and communications from Amazon. The group is in the initial stages of vetting applicants to ensure they won't relay information to the company, according to a post in the DSP Signal chat. After consulting with a military veteran, the founders decided to create a structure of five-person cells to keep members of the larger organization anonymous in the event one cell is compromised. It remains uncertain whether the organization will gain enough momentum to effectively negotiate with Amazon. Deft's public debut during the busiest shopping season highlights the challenges business owners say their companies face. Delivery firms have been ramping up hiring and renting spare vans to keep pace with the holiday rush. But many DSPs say they lose money during the season despite the increased revenue because their costs also balloon. Amazon reimburses owners for vans based on the number of routes they are supposed to run. But many company owners say they must keep a higher number of vehicles on hand than Amazon budgets for to account for breakdowns or other issues. Those extra vans eat into a delivery company's earnings, but the alternative of dropping a route can lead to lost bonuses and reduced delivery loads. Fleet owners say they have been contending with rising insurance costs and other operating expenses that have eroded margins since the DSP program started, while Amazon's fee schedule has stayed largely flat. In September, Amazon said it would increase per-package payments to DSPs by 2 cents and increase the minimum wage for delivery drivers. Deft's founders are aiming for larger fee increases that keep pace with their rising costs. One of the group's main targets is a new scoring system Amazon uses to rate the performance of delivery companies. In addition to being rated for on-time delivery and driver safety, DSP ratings are affected by customer complaints and whether they offer a positive environment for work. One of DSP's companies say they are finding it increasingly hard to hit the fantastic or fantastic plus ratings that trigger bonus payouts. Those additional payments are often the difference between making a profit or losing money for the week, the owners say. Airbus stumbles as Boeing recovers. For the first time in years, it is Airbus that finds itself under pressure. The European plane maker warned Wednesday that a quality problem with its best-selling A320 jets would lower deliveries this year, days after a separate issue on thousands of its aircraft required an urgent software fix. Boeing, meanwhile, has said it has made progress fixing its own production problems and told investors Tuesday it expects to generate more cash as it ramps up deliveries of its most popular aircraft next year. The announcements represent a potential reversal of fortunes for the world's two biggest plane makers, at least temporarily. Boeing has been mired in a series of production challenges in recent years, helping Airbus surge past its rival and cement its position as industry number one. Airbus said Wednesday it now expects to deliver about 790 commercial aircraft to customers this year, compared with a prior target of roughly 820. The reduction came after it discovered a supplier quality issue relating to the thickness of metal panels used to make its A320 line of jets. The company said the fault has been rectified and all newly produced panels are safe, though affected jets need to be inspected and a portion of those fixed, a process that will delay some deliveries. Airbus hasn't said how many planes may be affected, but told customers last week that as many as 628 jets could have defective panels installed, according to a confidential presentation reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. Most of those are still moving through the company's factories, including hundreds in the final stages before delivery. The A320 line of aircraft is by far Airbus's most important and best-selling, and has for decades competed head-on with Boeing's 737 models. The panels in question are made by a Spanish supplier and sit on top of the aircraft's cockpit and either side of the front doors. The panel problem, first disclosed Monday, came just days after Airbus warned that thousands of A320 jets required an urgent software fix. European and American regulators on Friday mandated fixes after a solar radiation event disrupted cockpit systems on an Airbus plane operated by JetBlue Airways in October. Despite the twin setbacks, Airbus on Wednesday reiterated its annual financial targets, helping shares rise more than 4% in Paris. The problem for Airbus come as Boeing appears to be emerging from the worst of its recent turbulence. Boeing's finance chief on Tuesday spelled out plans to generate more cash next year as the company ramps up production of its wide-body 787 and narrow-body 737 MAX jets. That would put the business miles ahead of where it stood a year ago when it was burning through cash reserves and had to sell stock to shore up its balance sheet. The U.S. company's executives say they have made progress ironing out some of the production line problems that prompted regulators to limit the company's jet output following a mid-air panel blowout in early 2024. Boeing won clearance in October to raise its 737 production to 42 jets a month, a tempo that will put the business on a firmer financial footing. The American plane maker still faces risks ahead. Boeing is working to complete its purchase of supplier Spirit AeroSystems, a company involved in many of the quality control issues that led regulators to clamp down on production rates in the first place. It has a long way to go to work down its order backlog. Boeing also pushed back the first deliveries of its long-delayed 777X wide-body jet model to 2027 after certain certification work took longer than expected. Airbus has been contending with a number of supply chain and supplier snarls too, including issues related to procuring engines and cabin equipment. And on to the front page. Admiral to contend survivors of boat strike were fair target. Commander to tell Congress that damaged craft tried to continue drug run. Washington. Two survivors of a September 2nd strike, U.S. strike, on a boat in the Caribbean were killed in follow-up attacks after they were seen still aboard the damaged vessel alongside packages of illegal narcotics, a senior commander is expected to tell lawmakers Thursday. Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley plans to say he and his legal advisor concluded the two survivors were attempting to continue their drug run, making them and the already damaged vessel legitimate targets for another attack, two defense officials said. The details of the strike have emerged as a key matter of concern for members of Congress, who are seeking more information about the role played by Bradley and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and whether aspects of the operation violated laws of war or Pentagon procedures. The version of events Bradley is expected to deliver would rebut claims by legal experts that the killing of the two survivors could have constituted a war crime. Lawmakers are likely to press Bradley, who commanded Joint Special Operations Command at the time, in the closed-door briefing on the extent of the damage to the boat, whether the men were injured, how Bradley reached his conclusions that the survivors were still legitimate targets, and whether he considered rescuing them. The attack was the first use of military force against drug boats by the administration and the only one in which survivors are known to have been targeted and killed in follow-up strikes. In mid-October, the Coast Guard rescued two survivors of an attack on a submersible because they were deemed unable to fight, according to the defense officials. The administration has launched 21 strikes in all, killing more than 80 people. Many law of the war analysts have criticized President Trump's assertion that drug traffickers are terrorists purposefully killing Americans rather than criminals providing illegal narcotics to willing buyers. They have homed in on whether the two survivors in the September 2nd attack should have been deemed out of action and therefore no longer legitimate military targets. The accounts of the attacks, provided so far by the administration have left even some Republicans questioning the legality. There's a difference between being accused of being a bad guy and being a bad guy. It is called the presumption of innocence, says Senator Rand Paul, R. Kentucky, often a critic of the administration's national security policy. It is called due process. It is called basically justice that our country was founded upon. Trump signaled support Wednesday for releasing the surveillance video of the operation taken by overhead aircraft. Bradley was watching the live feed as the operation unfolded, the Pentagon official said, as was Hegseth for part of the attack. The first part of the strike set the boat on fire and killed 9 people, the official said. It took an hour before the survivors were visible on the live feed, a third defense official said. Bradley, in making his decision, considered that other enemy vessels were nearby and that the survivors were believed to be communicating via radio with others in the drug smuggling network, the officials said. If the boat was incapacitated and the men were unable to threaten U.S. military personnel, then the survivors would have met the definition of unable to fight, legal experts say. However, if Bradley's account is accurate, it would appear to provide a legitimate explanation for the second strike, said Jeffrey Korn, a former military lawyer who now directs the Center for Military Law and Policy at Texas Tech University. Officials said that multiple contingencies had been built into the September 2nd plan, which Hegseth discussed ahead of the operation with General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as intelligence analysts and other military aides. One of the scenarios included what to do if there were armed survivors. I support the decision to knock out the boats and whoever is piloting those boats, because they are guilty of trying to kill people in our country, Trump told reporters Wednesday. You're going to find that this is war. The boat turned around before the strike, which some experts say calls into question the administration's claim that the traffickers posed an imminent threat to the U.S. Hegseth confirmed Tuesday that he authorized Bradley to lead the operation and back the additional strikes against the 2 survivors. Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat, the secretary told reporters during a cabinet meeting alongside Trump on Tuesday. Hegseth spent time ahead of the September 2nd operation receiving input from Kane, as well as intelligence officials and other military aides about the vessel and the people in it, according to one of the officials. That process, which included a days-long intelligence gathering effort, ended with Hegseth authorizing the mission and giving Bradley command. Excuse me. Mexican drug lords choose, snitch or suffer. More than 55 cartel leaders were turned over to the U.S. by their home country in a cloak and dagger missions. Mexico City. Dozens of Mexico's most dangerous prisoners, cuffed hand and foot, boarded army jets under heavy guard this year, a rogues gallery of cartel leaders responsible for smuggling tons of heroin, fentanyl, cocaine, and methamphetamine to insatiable U.S. buyers. The men were rousted from prisons where money and corruption provided them with weapons, cocaine, booze, women, and phones to run their lucrative underworld empires from behind bars, coordinating drug shipments as well as ordering killings and kidnappings, U.S. and Mexican officials said. The prisoners had no idea of their destination. Welcome to America, said Derek Maltz, interim head of the Drug Enforcement Administration, when he greeted the first batch of prisoners as they disembarked 9 months ago. A second group arrived in August, a total of 55 men who faced charges that could keep them locked in maximum security prisons for the rest of their lives. The prisoners represent the top echelons of Mexico's biggest criminal organizations, the Sinaloa, Jalisco New Generation, and Zetas cartels. They include Rafael Caro Quintero, who is charged with killing DEA agent Enrique Kiki Camarena in 1985 and has dodged extradition to the U.S. for decades. All are in custody without bail. U.S. officials expect many of the prisoners will share firsthand knowledge about the operations of Mexico's underworld, from smuggling secrets and money laundering operations to the names of officials in government, the military, law enforcement, and finance who are paid to serve the drug traffickers. Cartel leaders in U.S. custody have for years had the opportunity to cooperate with authorities, sometimes in exchange for reduced sentences and more comfortable prison conditions. Former Sinaloa cartel leader Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, who has kept mum, spends 23 hours a day in a windowless U.S. prison cell, serving a life sentence. One of his sons, Joaquin Guzman Lopez, turned himself into the U.S. authorities last year and dragged along another wanted man, his godfather, Ismael El Mayo Zambada, the 70-something co-founder of the Sinaloa cartel. Zambada, whose lawyer said he was illegally brought to the U.S., has pleaded guilty to drug charges. His sentencing hearing is January 13th. The younger Guzman pleaded guilty Monday to drug trafficking and money laundering charges. He is cooperating with U.S. authorities, prosecutors said at the court hearing. Transferring 55 drug leaders to U.S. custody was a high-stakes undercover mission that drew 2,000 Mexican special forces. Officials feared that if word got out, kingpins would attempt escapes, set off riots, or file legal appeals. Authorities also believed cartels might try to assassinate their own leaders rather than risk them spilling secrets to U.S. law enforcement. When the expulsion operation began, some prisoners thought they were headed to freedom, figuring their government bribes had paid off, a Mexican official said. Instead, they were shoved into armored personnel carriers and escorted to a military plane that flew them to the Altiplano Maximum Security Prison, about 50 miles west of Mexico City. The first prisoners boarded a half-dozen Mexican military planes on February 27th, headed for Chicago, Phoenix, San Antonio, New York, and Dulles International Airport in Virginia. Rival drug lords who had ordered the killings of thousands of each other's men sat side by side on the flight. Never in the history of our agency have we seen this level of bad guys being removed from Mexico, Maltz, the former DEA chief, said in an interview. Among them were the brothers Miguel Angel and Omar Trevino, leaders of the paramilitary Zetas drug gang. The setup. The Trevinos have killed 18 prison officers since their capture more than 10 years ago, a senior Mexican official said, sometimes reciting the names out loud in a show of impunity. They controlled a network of more than 600 inmates in various locales, what officials called a prison cartel that terrorized communities from behind bars. Officials monitored the brothers' phone calls for clues that they had a hint of the removal plans. They worried the brothers' private army of former Mexican Special Forces soldiers would set fire to trailer trucks and buses, blocking highways and stirring havoc in towns and cities if the Trevinos learned what was in store. An intelligence team spoke with rivals of the Trevinos' men who revealed that they knew about the brothers' informant networks and the security teams that protected their families. Rivals provided the names of financial operators who paid informants, hitmen, and top-flight lawyers who might try to impede the brothers' removal. The Trevinos successfully thwarted extradition attempts 133 times through court appeals, according to the Mexican government. Shackled and dressed in tan jumpsuits, the brothers descended the stairs of a Mexican military plane in Dulles, Virginia, escorted by Mexican special forces in balaclavas and black tactical gear, and placed in the hands of U.S. authorities. They have since pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking and money laundering charges. Mexico expelled the 55 prisoners on a national security grounds, allowing Mexican officials to bypass requirements to notify the prisoners' legal representatives. The removals were dubious from a legal standpoint, subverting due process and legal proceedings linked to extradition treaties signed by Mexico, say lawyers, security analysts, and former officials. The expulsion was taken for the security and peace of our country and is part of the collaboration with the U.S., President Claudia Sheinbaum said in September. The imprisoned cartel leaders threatened government officials, Mexican officials said. Lawyers representing several of the prisoners filed legal challenges afterwards, but none succeeded. Picking leaders from all major cartels and their factions showed that the Sheinbaum administration wasn't favoring any of them, the officials said. The idea of using Mexico's national security laws was first floated during the Biden administration, said people familiar with the bilateral talks. But the catalyst to action was pressure from the Trump administration, including threat of punitive tariffs if Mexico didn't step up its drug trafficking enforcement, said one of the people familiar with the talks. Mexican officials believe the expulsions have helped Sheinbaum avoid U.S. intervention. They feared that without stepped-up cooperation, the Trump administration might have conducted targeted killings or drone strikes on fentanyl labs, plunging U.S.-Mexico relations into a crisis. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said last month at a Group of Seven summit in Canada that the U.S. wouldn't conduct military operations in Mexico without consent from the Sheinbaum administration. We are not going to take unilateral decisions, he said. Convoy decoy. Weeks before the first man was escorted from his cell, authorities took control of more than a dozen Mexican prisons, hoping to avoid information leaks and escape attempts, officials said. Prison directors were replaced. Catering companies were switched out to protect the men from poisoning. New camera surveillance suppliers were hired. Prison custodians were replaced with special forces to avoid anyone tipping off cartel leaders. Some inmates were kept isolated to prevent information sharing. The military flights to the Altiplano prison required stopovers to pick up men from across Mexico. A wall of flat screens in a secret bunker in Mexico City kept track. A hand-picked catering crew prepared meals under strict health and safety protocols. The prisoners got medical checkups to ensure they were delivered to the U.S. in good health, officials said. The government consulted studies to identify the hours of lightest traffic from Altiplano to an airstrip near Mexico City, where the men would board flights to the U.S. Officials closely monitored Altiplano security camera surveillance. The prison is where El Chapo staged a notorious escape in 2015, slipping through a hole in his cell into a tunnel equipped with a motorcycle on rails that led to a nearby safe house. Servando Latuta Gomez was one of the most closely watched. The former middle school teacher ran methamphetamine labs in the state of Michoacán for years and collected enemies inside and outside of prison. As the day for his transfer to the U.S. drew closer, authorities monitored the communication of Gomez's family, as well as bank activity by his closest confidants, watching for transactions that would suggest he was preparing an escape. Mexico froze bank accounts tied to shell companies that funded informant networks and used to pay lawyers, according to another person familiar with the operation. Days before Gomez's transfer in August, special forces left the prison in a convoy of armed vehicles headed to Mexico City as a decoy passing through areas where Gomez commanded loyal underlings. A second, more discreet convoy ferried the drug lord on a different route, the person said. A drone flew above the convoys providing surveillance. Gomez faces drug trafficking charges in the U.S. and has a court hearing scheduled this month. His lawyer declined to comment. A third transfer of Mexican drug bosses to the U.S. is under discussion, said people familiar with the plans. Waymos are done being nice. Self-driving cars learn to bend rules of the road. San Francisco. It was like a scene out of a movie. A pair of white jaguars zipping through a two-lane tunnel, changing lanes at the same time in a zigzag formation. But this one had a twist. They were both Waymos, the self-driving vehicles known for their achingly cautious behavior. I had never seen anyone switch lanes in that tunnel, said Sophia Yen, a startup founder who was in her car behind the two autonomous ones in September. It's driving more like a taxi driver, an aggressive New York taxi driver. For years, while training on the streets of San Francisco and eventually transporting passengers, Waymos were the most polite drivers on the road. Pull up to a stop sign at the same time as a Waymo, and it would wait, as if to say, no, please, after you. If you were trying to go around another car making a left, a Waymo was sure to let you in. The training wheels are off, like the rule-following nice guy who's tired of being taken advantage of. Waymos are putting their own needs first. They're bending traffic laws, getting impatient with pedestrians, and embracing the idea that when it comes to city driving, politeness doesn't pay. In September, police in San Bruno, California, pulled over a Waymo after witnessing it make an illegal U-turn. Last month, a Waymo hit and killed a well-known neighborhood cat in the Mission District. On a recent Thursday in Pacific Heights, a Waymo at a multi-lane four-way stop hit the gas along with the car next to it so it wouldn't have to wait its turn. Seconds later, the same car decided signaling a lane change wasn't necessary. Jennifer Jeffries, 54, has logged nearly 3,000 minutes in Waymos since May 2024. Until recently, the Pacific Heights resident wouldn't take one if she was headed downtown. They weren't agile enough. She once got stuck for several minutes behind another car that was double parked while furniture was being unloaded. She now has no problem taking Waymos downtown and finds they maneuver as well as an Uber driver, maybe better. They will go around a car or get closer to a car than a human driver would, said Jeffries. Sometimes I'll be in the back seat and I'll be like, oh, that was really close. One drawback? They seem to be mimicking Uber drivers in less helpful ways. You say pick me up at this address, and they're across the street, which I don't appreciate, she says. Mark Schreibner, 49, liked it better when Waymos were strict followers of traffic laws. While walking to the gym, Schreibner found himself in a crosswalk opposite a Waymo. As soon as he made it past the front of the vehicle, it started accelerating. I was taken off guard, said Schreibner. My next thought was, oh, they've changed the programming to be more aggressive. He was right. Waymo has been trying to make its cars confidently assertive, said Chris Ludwig, a senior director of product management with Waymo, which is owned by Google parent Alphabet. That was really necessary for us to actually scale this up in San Francisco, especially because of how busy it gets. Ludwig says when the vehicles are too passive, they become disruptive. Regular software updates ensure Waymos aren't becoming a nuisance or creating chaos. Ludwig wouldn't comment on specific incidents of rule breaking. He says Waymos make common sense decisions, which involve trade-offs. The driver is designed to respect the rules of the road, said Ludwig. However, sometimes this is a nuanced topic, and road rules can even conflict with each other. For example, he says you're not supposed to cross a double yellow line, but you also shouldn't obstruct traffic. So if you get stuck behind a stop delivery truck A human would go around it, even if it meant crossing the double line. Now Waymos know to do that, too. A Waymo spokeswoman said its vehicles have driven 100 million driverless miles across San Francisco, Los Angeles, Austin, Phoenix, and Atlanta. The company reported that compared with human drivers, it has had 91% fewer crashes involving a serious injury or worse. Cosette Drossler, 65, said a friend recently told her about a Waymo pulling a California stop. The car apparently slowed down but didn't reduce its speed to zero. Drossler, who lives in Pacific Heights, feels conflicted. She doesn't want to be behind a Waymo that's coming to a complete stop in a quiet neighborhood when there's no one around. She also doesn't entirely trust them to appropriately judge the risk. I do California rolling stops. I grew up in San Francisco, said Drossler, adding, I only do it if it's safe. Waymo says its cars are designed to come to a full stop. Police Sergeant Scott Smithmungtull was on patrol in San Bruno looking for impaired drivers when he and his partner got to talking about Waymos and how they were starting to drive more like humans. Just then, a Waymo opposite them in the intersection made a U-turn. The pair looked up, saw the no U-turn sign, and put their lights on. The Waymo pulled over. As Smithtengall's partner approached the driver's side window, it rolled down. A Waymo operator's voice came on through a speaker. They said they would look into it, he says. They were really, really apologetic. Currently, cops in California can't cite a car without a driver. The law is about to change. Private hiring fell last month, ADP estimates. Hiring by American businesses dropped last month, according to an estimate from payroll processor ADP, a further setback for a labor market that has slowed this year. Private employers shed 32,000 jobs in November, ADP estimated, a swing from the 47,000 private sector jobs that ADP estimated were added in October. Analysts surveyed by the Wall Street Journal were expecting to see 40,000 new private sector jobs. ADP's numbers, which come from the anomalized payrolls of ADP's corporate clients, have long been on economists' radar. Since October, though, they have taken on special importance given the vacuum of official economic data caused by the recent government shutdown. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, still in catch-up mode 3 weeks after the shutdown ended, won't release its look at the November jobs picture until December 16th, 2.5 weeks behind schedule. When the BLS report arrives later this month, it will present a more comprehensive picture of the job market that also includes the public sector with data on how the government shutdown and job losses for federal workers shaped overall employment. The government figures are based on an official survey that may reach a broader, more diverse set of companies. Trump to roll back rules on fuel economy. Move will lower the requirement for passenger cars and kill credits system. President Trump on Wednesday said he plans to roll back federal fuel economy rules for passenger vehicles, his latest move to relieve the U.S. auto industry from mandates to build cleaner, more fuel-efficient cars. The administration's move comes months after Congress and the Trump administration this summer essentially nullified the mandates, known as Corporate Average Fuel Economy Rules, or CAFE, by eliminating fines for violating them. Under the changes, the federal government will require an average of 34.5 miles a gallon for vehicles by model year 2031, down from the 50.4 miles a gallon standard set by the Biden administration. It also does away with a system in which automakers can buy credits from competitors to offset fines, a setup that proved to be a boon for electric vehicle maker Tesla. Lowering the standards would enshrine into federal law more lenient miles per gallon targets for automakers. It could make it harder to return to tougher standards, since doing so would require more than simply reinstating penalties. We're protecting our auto workers and we're making it easier for every family to afford high-quality cars, Trump said from the Oval Office. In other words, we're bringing automobiles back and the manufacturing of automobiles back into this country. The proposal must undergo an official rulemaking process before being adopted. The changes would apply to all model year passenger cars and light trucks from 2022 to 2031. And that's it for today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Ken, your volunteer reader here at the Talking Information Center, and I thank you for listening.